chers collègues, c'est un très grand privilège pour moi d'être ici avec vous aujourd'hui et je remercie surtout les organisateurs de ce colloque pour leur invitation. Elle me donne l'occasion de vous présenter mon projet de recherche, Work in Progress, une présentation qui est conçue, au moins par moi, comme un échange. Je suis au début de ce projet et je suis convaincue que ma présentation va bientôt être finie et appelle des approfondissements dans tous ses sens. Je crois également que chacun d'entre vous aura, plus tôt ou plus tard, quelque chose à me dire, des remarques critiques, des supplémentaires à contribuer. Je vous invite de me donner vos commentaires maintenant, pendant les deux jours qui viennent, ou un moment plus tard. Quel est l'homme sage? L'homme sage est celui qui écoute. Donc, je suis vraiment prête à vos commentaires et de les intégrer à mon propre projet. Et je vous remercie pour ça en avance. Donc, repensons donc la guerre ensemble. Et je vais le faire avec 5 questions exemplaires. Ce n'est pas du tout des questions exotiques, mais exemplaires. Qui peut-on légitimement tuer dans la guerre? Qui sont les combattants? Quels sont leurs buts? Comment doit-on se battre? Comment les guerres sont-elles terminées? In order to rethink war, let's start with the word itself, which may set us on a useful path of inquiry. The Latin word bellum, according to Cicero, originally came from duellum. The word war, guerre, comes from wirren, confusion, disorder, chaos. There is an awful lot more to be said about the etymology of war, or of other words meaning war in other European languages, but today I want to confine myself to exploring these two aspects, the duality of war and the chaos of war on which we try to impose conceptual order. Let's start with a duel. War as a clash of two sides is a subject we thus find since antiquity. It was then commented upon from Giovanni da Legnano in the 14th century to Clausewitz and his many acolytes. It reflects a human, a European, predisposition towards dualism, as found also in black and white, night and day, good and evil, while apparently the Asian yin and yang are less mutually exclusive. Admittedly, scholars since Giovanni da Legnano realized that in war, both sides may believe themselves to be good, i.e. on the side of justice. And thus gradually, the good versus evil, or just versus unjust dimension, receded in international law, but it returned in the 20th century. In popular perception, however, the good versus evil view of war was very strong in all religious wars. After a slump from 1648 until 1792, it regained massively in strength on another level since the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, as wars ceased to be cabinet or really dynastic wars and turned nationalist. Nationalism unleashed hatred to degrees unseen since the religious wars. We had thought that after 1945, nationalism was overcome, but a more enlightened view of the world and the embracing of shared values of human rights and democracy in the liberal West, and by its denial in the communist view of class struggle in the socialist world. After 1991, however, we have witnessed the resurgence of nationalism in Eastern Europe in particular. Countries outside Europe, like India or many Arab states that have not been through the bloody catharsis of the Second World War, had never abandoned the nationalist dualism of this us versus them that has infected the world, spreading from its hearth in Europe in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Also, while Europe seemed to have found consensus in laicisme, for which there's no proper English word, Islam never settled for rendering to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. Thus, religion is not dead as an interpretive prism, and fuels binary perceptions of friend and foe in the Middle East and beyond. The duel also underlies most classical writing on strategy, which I do not want to go into here, For obvious reasons, it largely defines war as a zero-sum game, with any gains an enemy makes as our loss, and any gains we make as his loss. The advent of nuclear weapons supposedly introduced a change here, pointing to something I shall return to later, but which bears flagging up even now. Namely, the imposition of restrictions and the working towards mutually agreed, perhaps only by tacit consensus, rules as imposition of limits on war. In this case, the mutual desire to prevent nuclear war without totally giving up the use of force as an instrument of politics. Let us turn then to that second aspect of war that is captured in the etymology of the French and English word for it. So to remind you, war and guerre come from a Germanic word meaning disorder, confusion. As noted before, Europeans tend to see things in binary patterns. From this approach, disorder and confusion is the opposite of order, rule-bound behavior, the rule of law. Probably a more general and not just European proclivity of human analysis is to try to impose order on the world, especially if disorder equates pain and suffering. Remaining with binary patterns, this creates a paradox. Much thinking and writing about war revolves around attempts to impose rules on what is the extreme of unruly behavior. The rules invariably are restraints in some forms, limitations of violence. This is where the commonality of this pattern ends. The limitations that people have tried to impose tend to be, if not entirely random or arbitrary, then at least strongly culture-dependent. Let me give you examples. The first concerns the delimitation of war from lesser forms of violent conflict. Across several European cultures, the idea emerged that war can have some legitimacy that distinguishes it, for example, from armed robbery, from raiding to steal cattle, goods, or people to turn into slaves. The very custom of raiding seems to have given birth to the notion of a legitimate war aimed at retrieving stolen property or abducted humans. Think of the origins of the Trojan War. Nevertheless, small wars, difficult to distinguish from armed robbery, continue to exist in Europe and beyond. Think of the bands of klefti of Greece under Ottoman rule, the word kleftos means robber, who were smugglers and bandits one day and Greek independence fighters another. Or think of the drug wars in Latin America, which in numbers and aims bear comparison with European medieval wars that resolved so much around booty and taking prisoners that could be held for ransom. A second, not unrelated distinction is that between private war and public war, between a family feud on the one hand and a war sanctioned by a higher authority. The history of the European Middle Ages, which you know more than me, and indeed of early modern times, revolves in good part around attempts to monopolize the use of force within states, and thus to ban private war. A third distinction we come across repeatedly is that of legitimate versus illegitimate insurgency, rebellion against authority, which implies an uprising against the established order of things. The latter in European cultures is almost invariably seen as a punishable offense, even though some cultures articulate a rationale for tyrannicide or for the fight for freedom or national independence, thus seeking legitimation for their rejection of such an authority. From the Romans to the Russians today, regimes in Europe have sought to portray and have tended to treat rebels as criminals, whether they be slaves or Gauls or Chechens, rather than as legitimate combatants, and have treated them quite differently, with far greater brutality, when caught and subjected, than adversaries defined as legitimate. All three distinctions between legitimate forms of wars and illegitimate forms depend heavily on who defines what is legitimate, i.e. on who has the power to define what is legitimate and what is not. All three, seen retrospectively, are somewhat arbitrary, and if politically motivated, impositions of categorizations on a reality that presented cases of all shapes and sizes along a sliding scale on which no clear lines can be drawn by nature. This is a central pattern emerging from any closer look at definitions of war. Definitions are strongly dependent on the historical context in which they are formulated, and they reflect the interests of the party formulating them. As a result, definitions of war made in one context rarely fully apply in another, as so many circumstances change. I'm not saying war does not exist, as there seems to be a convergence of opinion that many, perhaps all cultures, have a notion of something large-scale, violent, that creates disorder and destruction in the extreme, and in which at least two sides are pitted against each other. What I am saying, however, is that the narrow phenomenon that people had in mind when they defined war was always culture and context specific. Here are some examples. Let us start with a simple quantitative example. Primatologists or archaeologists will see evidence of war when flanges of 40 apes give battle with another tribe of apes, or when a mass grave with 30 skeletons is found that have met with a violent death. When at the Thermopylae, Leonidas 300 encountered the Persians, and assuming that they killed twice as many Persians as they numbered themselves, the total number of battlefield casualties would not have qualified this epic historic battle as war, according to the reckoning of the Correlates of War project. That Correlates of War project defines war as something with at least 1,000 battlefield deaths. But a battle with 1,000 deaths is closer quantitatively to what the Spartans and Persians experienced in 480 BCE than is the so-called Battle of Verdun, which lasted for months and saw the deaths of perhaps 300,000 men. Admittedly, I'm cheating a little bit here, because the Second Persian War, of which the Thermopylae battle was the central land battle, was decided by a naval battle with unknown numbers of casualties. And these would probably have lifted the whole war across the Correlates of War threshold. But curiously, the Correlates of War project defines homes, a definition homes in on battlefield deaths. The assumption here is that most wars take place on land, and also ignores civilian deaths, which in the Second Persian Wars would have been numerous. To move on to further examples, think of the wars as conceived by Sun Tzu. The wars Sun Tzu had in mind were closer in nature to insurgencies or people's wars in modern times than to modern state-on-state war. You can see how during the French Revolutionary Wars, Carnot was inspired by some of Sun Tzu's thoughts, whom he read, when he planned a French-backed insurgency in Wales and in the west of England. But the wars of Napoleon and his huge armies were altogether very different from the wars of Sun Tzu. Clausewitz, in turn, found it difficult to escape the paradigm of the Napoleonic Wars and to come to a more general view of war, although he tried hard to do so in the last years of his life. Let us turn to who can be killed in war. The actual wars people had in mind also affected their imposition of mostly dual categorizations in other ways. These include the definitions of who can be killed in war and who cannot, today expressed in terms of combatants versus civilians. All this is important as context-specific definitions and definitions rooted in very old European philosophical traditions dominate the law of armed conflict. If one enters war, the unilateral collateral killing of civilians can be excused by military necessity. If one is not at war, it cannot. Civil war does not qualify as war in this context, which is, I understand, why France declared a martial law after the Paris attacks a year ago. Let us begin with a little case study of who is in fact killed, as opposed to who should be targeted or can be targeted in war according to the laws of armed conflict. The prehistoric mass burial site of Jabal Sahaba and of Talheim, both of which can be attributed to killing rather than an epidemic, show both male and female skeletons and also children. From 1500 to 1200 BCE, Egyptian records say that in war, men, women, and the offspring of the enemies were killed. The inhabitants, men, women, and children, of besieged cities which did not surrender were killed indiscriminately by the Assyrians in the following period. These are early examples of women and children being killed in war. Homing in on the women, ancient Greeks venturing into what today is Ukraine would quickly have lost any inhibitions about fighting and killing women. as these were, this was where the Amazons lived. In their own culture, however, Greeks usually enslaved women and children, be they Greek or barbarian, while men would generally be killed, even if they were unarmed or disarmed. Greeks and Romans were wont to kill captured and combatants, or even to massacre all males of cities or tribes they've conquered, while leading women and children into captivity. Alexander the Great was not an exception when he had 8,000 men massacred, two of them by crucifixion, after he took Tyre in 322 BCE. Hannibal in the Punic Wars was said to kill prisoners, and he captured enemy combatants, now disarmed. The Romans likewise did so at Samnium, Leontini, Antipatria, Capua, Corinth, and Capsa. They also committed massacres during the Jewish Wars, the Wars against the Jewish Uprisings. Emperor Vespasian ordered the crucifixion at a rate of 500 per day. The Romans thus seem to have had no inhibition about killing women and children also, although they, like the men, were more valuable as slaves. When Christianity became tolerated and then became the established state religion of the Roman Empire, the church began to introduce limitations on killing and destruction in war, starting with its own personnel, clerics and monks. A century later, in the East Roman Empire, Emperor Maurice prescribed the killing of the harmless, i.e. the innocent, in war. Yet a century later, the law of innocence, as it was actually called, found in Iona, spelled out specifically the protection of women and clerics and the protection of church property. This notion that women were to be spared has lived on until this day, but it would be a very good research project to establish how far it was ever obeyed. John Gillingham, for example, in his research on the Middle Ages, has shown that it was, on the whole, not until the 12th century. So. For example, the much romanticized Crusader King Richard III of the First of England, after the siege and capture of Acre in 1190-1191, had 2,700 Muslims killed, including women and children, who had surrendered on the assumption that they would be ransomed and not killed. And when it came to the persecution of people defined as heretics, whether this was the Albigensian Crusade or the religious wars of the 16th century, women and children were by no means spared. Also, if a besieged town did not surrender but was taken by force, all restraints were suspended. And in a tradition which we sadly see living on in Aleppo today, all townsfolk were equally at the usually non-existent mercy of the conquerors. If it made the blindest bit of difference, I would dedicate my talk today to the people of Aleppo, but I'm not into empty gestures. Indeed, even for regular warfare, Jean-Jacques Rousseau described the prevalent thinking of his times, which was that the sovereign declared war on behalf of his own nation, on another sovereign, whose whole nation was therefore in principle seen as the enemy, or the two nations considered each other as their enemy therefore. And since women and children are subjects of each nation, they should also be counted as enemies. He added that this did not and that should not mean that they should be treated exactly the way as combatants, but here we see the principle spelled out that war pits nation against nations and all members of one nation against all members of another, regardless of whether they are men, women, or children. In the following century and a half, dominated by nationalism, the baseline remained the same, with only the monarch being taken out of the equation. There is a logic here which I, for one, have not been able to refute. If in a democracy a majority elects a government, the nation as a whole is represented by this government. If this government decides to go to war, it does so on behalf of the entire nation. It does not help the minority that voted for other parties to dissociate itself from this war by putting flags with rainbows on their houses or carrying posters saying, "I'm against it." Technically speaking, this could not be recognized by an artillerist 500 meters away or by a pilot flying a bomber plane. The German general Ludendorff, who reflected National Socialist thinking on the matter, also saw the entire enemy nation as inimical and as proper object in warfare, not least as women were those who would bear the next generation of enemy soldiers. To Ludendorff, even the baby in the cradle was either the soldier or the soldier bearer of tomorrow. Indeed, already for Émeric Vatel, writing only a few decades after Rousseau, women forfeited any right to protection if they took up arms. And there is indeed little reason why a woman soldier should be treated differently from a male combatant, or a woman non-combatant, or woman civilian from a male civilian. But the question remains whether the military drone operator of either sex back in Las Vegas or the civil servant in the government can truly be seen as a non-combatant, or whether the sovereign population of a state with which one is at war, and indeed one's own, can be seen as non-responsible for the actions of a government they have elected. In short, we see here that views on who could be killed in the rule-based war differ considerably, not just in practice, but also in theory, and the same applies to who is allowed or expected to fight in war. There are few species of animals in which mothers would not defend their young against an attacker, and in many species, for example birds, the fathers will do likewise. One can speculate that any small human hunter-gatherer community under threat is and has always been likely to mobilize all its members for collective defense against external aggression. But as human communities became larger, division of labor was introduced. Supposedly, all in the European cultures have a division of labor between the caste of priests, the caste of warriors, and the caste of the peasant. But already the early Roman ideal, very important for subsequent millennia of European history, was that of the peasant soldier. Still, in most societies, and not just the Indo-European sphere, at some stage, a division between combatants and non-combatants or civilians was introduced. Combatants usually consisted of all of the adult men or a selection of them. The latter usually consisted of young children, old and handicapped people, and more often than not, of women, of a priest caste, and sometimes other people who were protected professionals. In many societies, soldiering became a special profession of only a selection of men, often volunteers. Their configuration and recruitment was highly context-specific, and yet it was often the subject of political debate and ideologically laden dispute. Political philosophers from Socrates to Machiavelli, Guibert and Carnot went to great lengths to extol the advantages and virtues of one system over another. Universal manhood military service versus professional militaries, native soldiers versus mercenaries, and so on. Comparing these divisions as developed by different societies over time and space shows how very constructed, as opposed to natural, they are. This can also be seen in the debate about women in the armed forces, which is colored by political demands for equality or for armed forces that are representative of the society as a whole, rather than by what they can physically actually do. With the advent of nationalism, which turned the wars of princes into wars of entire nations against other nations, and with the industrialization of warfare, civilians could contribute to the war effort in increasingly direct ways. Even as the Red Cross and international lawyers struggled to build an international regime of the laws of war to protect civilians from its ravages, in the early 20th century, Italian General Giulio Douay, but also his British counterpart, General J.O.C. Fuller, argued that differences between civilians and soldiers could not be upheld. Douay, who has worked for Mussolini's fascist state, and quoting him almost verbatim, the British politician Lord Halsbury, argued the factory worker producing shells was just as crucial to the war effort as the soldier in the front line on which they built their advocacy for city bombing. In today's more common variants of war where non-state actors are often pitted against states, the distinction between combatants and non-combatants is often questioned by both sides. State authorities see the binary categorization as shading into a spectrum with active fighters on one end and with supporters and assistants, including those who transport, deploy, or protect, or hide weapons, occupying the vast middle ground, and passive sympathizers on the other end. If members of the middle range are killed, are they to be counted among unintended civilian casualties, or among the legitimately targeted combatants, defined more loosely? This problem of categorization explains the different ways in which the Israelis count collateral casualties as the result of Israeli Operation Protective Edge in the Gaza War of 2014. Israelis argue that many of those who were killed were de facto combatants. As the Israelis were targeting Palestinian rocket launchers, it was only logical that those hiding, transporting, or helping set up these rockets would become casualties, and those activities made them combatants. Here, as in combating child soldiers, for example, the line between war crime and legitimate self-defense is often blurred. Another binary concept has been imposed, albeit in varying ways over time, you will not be surprised to hear, to distinguish between regular and irregular soldiers. Proper soldiers defending their own polity or foreign mercenaries. We have mentioned already the distinction often made between external war and internal war, distinguished in Greek by the terms polemos and stasis, but this distinction can rarely be upheld. Civil wars or insurgencies more often than not involve external support from at least one state. Meanwhile, many interstate wars involve fifth columns within the enemy state, and massive propaganda campaigns conducted from the outside, from the pulpit or the minbar, to flyers and leaflets, to modern media of mass communication. The role specialization we talked about earlier between the warrior and the peasant often cuts across state boundaries. Professional warriors, often the younger brothers of the peasant who inherited the family land, had to put their own sword to hire if the economy could not sustain a standing army, as was the case in Europe in the Middle Ages. For large stretches of European history, the professional soldier was a mercenary who went wherever there was work for him. The reality was rarely as binary. Many, or perhaps most armies, a good subject for a quantitative research project, incidentally, seem to have combined both. Charles Sack, Le Sage of France, employed crack forces of Scotsmen along with his feudal levies. On the other side of the Hundred Years' War, the Plantagenet kings conscripted Welsh and English soldiers along with the mercenaries hired on the continent. Famously, the termination of that long conflict led to bands of unemployed professional soldiers roaming Europe to find work or plunder and steal if they did not, and that they were called écorcheurs speaks for itself. Then in the following centuries, Swiss, Germans, Scotsmen, and men from other parts of Europe were for hire in war. This pattern can still be found in the 18th century, when after the defeat of the Catholic Jacobites in Scotland in 1746, many Scottish and other British and Irish Catholics wandered around Europe in search of work. But were they purely mercenaries? There are so many recorded cases of them fighting for one confession only in these wars, which were still tinged with religious dimensions, that they were perhaps really jihadists. Here I can flag another excellent topic for a large quantitative comparative research project. The rise of nationalism from the French Revolution onwards made the citizen soldier the norm, even if Napoleon's armies contained many foreigners, Poles, Swiss, Irishmen, Danes, you name it. And strongly nation-minded armies, as those of the successive French republics or the British army, continued to carry, along with the citizen soldier or the national recruits, units of spahis or sepoys, those terms actually are derived from the Persian, of askaris, from the Turkish, or gurkhas, who, as their very name suggests, came from far away. Even during the most nationalist of wars, the two world wars of the 20th century, the respective sides fielded what was effectively foreigners. In the First World War, these remained colonial forces, while in the Second World War, the Germans decided to suspend their own racial preferences to bring in Walloons, Flemings, Frenchmen, Dutchmen, and Croats in foreign legions that joined the Wehrmacht. Even the SS set up foreign divisions. As in so many other aspects, the National Socialist worldview was stretched and patched with extraordinary logical constructs to fit the needs created by reality, and the result does not always stand up to logical scrutiny. Nevertheless, generally one can say that in widely differing approaches to war, that who can be killed and fight we find very distinct worldviews and value systems, closely interwoven with the experiences of the individual writers. They may have rejected what they had experienced and sought to change things, or they may have accepted it or at least described it as a norm, as Rousseau did. The most educated among them, if they read Latin or Greek, also had older models to draw upon. But in general, even these older models were generally interpreted through the prism of their own experience. People tend to articulate their own feelings, aims and ambitions in terms and categories that they have been brought up to find acceptable and appropriate. Think of the discovery of the post-traumatic stress disorder in the 20th century. It must have existed in previous times, but somehow it was a taboo subject, just as the horrors of childbirth are even today. Soldiers were sometimes described in the past as having le mal du pays. It was also noted something like homesickness, but we also think from the descriptions of the time that the mal du pays was something like PTSD at times. Nevertheless, it was not recognized as a more general phenomenon. With this in mind, let's turn now to war aims, leaving aside straightforward raiding warfare such as that of Genghis Khan or the Huns. For polities that have lived and continue to live alongside each other, I think this is what Jean Béchelaire means by transpolitie. War is often conceptualized as caused by dispute, and in this context, justice is evoked, usually by both sides, as recognized by thinkers on the subject since Giovanni da Vignano. But the narrow causes of wars, the spark or even the powder keg, are not the only determinants for war aims. War aims range from very limited, the freeing of hostages or the recovery of stolen property, to very far-reaching, conquest of land, enslavement or even extermination of the population there. The Greeks and Romans conventionally saw wars as either revolving around sieges of crucial towns or around frontal battles that would be won by the side that could demonstrate its success by staying on the battlefield overnight. This is what armies prepared to do. The convention also demanded that the defeated party withdrew from the battlefield and accepted its defeat. In addition to such expectations, cultures drawing on Greek and Roman literature had similar expectations, and like the ancients, found it very annoying if a defeated party did not admit defeat but continue to fight in an irregular way, even after they'd lost the regular Hauptschlacht, the supposedly decisive battle. Accordingly, such irregulars would be treated with much more harshness. They would be punished, in fact, for refusing to submit to the arbitrament of Mars, as Kufinov called it, and for refusing to accept the outcome of a battle as decisive and final. Turning to siege warfare, admittedly, there is a certain timeless logic in the hate-driven aim of devastating the enemy's housing, his villages, his towns, his city. But whether there was a capital town or not, and whether if that was occupied, the enemy would collapse and surrender, depended very much on the mentality of the time, and there are many wonderful instances where an adversary did not accept defeat after his central town was taken, think of Moscow in the Wars of Napoleon. I'm not arguing that war aims are driven exclusively by culture. Means and geography are also essential factors. These factors are interrelated, however. We see them all coming together when some Frankish or Saxon ruler, barely out of the caves or down from the trees, suddenly styled himself Emperor of the Romans and fought his way across the Alps and down to Italian Latium to have himself crowned in Rome, as this was the expectation, derived from collective memory and ancient texts. How are such aims articulated and agreed upon? This seems to depend heavily on the imagination, or lack of it, of those who do the defining and on the culture they share with those to support and whom they seek for their enterprise. The who agrees is usually an elite, and it is astonishing to what extent such elites manage to garner the support of illiterate masses for loftier and grand strategic aims that these illiterate masses can barely have understood. Think of the Renovatio Imperii Romanorum of Otto III, or the Jeu et mon droit of the English monarchs, or the Non sufficit orbis of Philip II of Spain. Here is another superb subject for research that one should flag. What illiterate or barely literate people who with greater or lesser enthusiasm flocked to the colors when their lords called to war actually thought they fought for, and why they accepted that this is up to them to fight for this. A nice challenge, as so few of them voted down being illiterate. The military and their masters often define war aims in the light of tools available to wage war. Conflicts are often approached as though one tried to kill a spider with a hammer because one has a hammer, but not insecticide or a mosquito net. Most modern militaries assumed that they had to kill the spider rather than catch it and throw it out of the window. With some conflicts, the very notion that they have to be resolved through war may be cultural dependent. And more still, some cultures seem to need bloody conflicts to perpetrate their own values. Indo-European cultures, but actually others as well, like the older Japanese or every anthropologist's favorite, the Yanomami, always like to have warriors as their ideals rather than ideals of merchant mediators or philosopher pacifiers. And warriors cannot be warriors unless there is war. Many repressive systems have needed an external enemy to excuse the repression of freedom. War aims as pretexts for staying in power. Critics such as Émeric Rousset, Grotius, or the Duke of Sully, advisor of Henry IV, have often alleged that the just causes of war cited were little more than that. Nevertheless, pretext or not, it has usually been necessary to put forward reasons with which those who are doing the fighting could associate, and with which they could, in extremis, estimate worth their own blood. This, incidentally, is where the so-called realist school of international relations theory has got it wrong. Few people will be aroused merely by the promise of booty. Humans like to see themselves as moral and ethical, not as criminal and base. They like to turn even the basest of instincts into an uplifting and ethical motivation. In this context, a word about the binary greed versus grievance debate. It is again a fallacy, fallaciously binary interpretation applied to a multifaceted reality. In most cases, we find both, plus multiple other factors such as reputation and honor, or the desire to please a vengeful, monstrous deity by killing those that displease the deity. Externalizing one's own frustration by killing humans defined as horrible heathens, as kafir or worse, heretics and renegades, all people who have been defined as subhuman yet as dangerous enemies to one's own society, give many people great satisfaction. Of course, the very assumption that this problem must be solved by war rather than negotiation is particular to some cultures, as is the equally culture-dependent assumption that the issue at hand is a zero-sum game. In wars that drag on, war aims can change considerably over time. Constructs are prominent aims, the aims of liberty and liberties or freedoms, which is articulated in recurrent wars since antiquity, has been used as a catch-all which, when unpacked, contained amazingly different assortments of demands, while often lacking demands which we would see as essential to freedom. To take other war aims from today's perspective, it is difficult to follow how in the past people would fight for an infant's right to be king, or over the iota subscripta in the Nicene Creed. From a 21st century Western perspective, where the status quo is largely seen as satisfactory, it is unintelligible how in other societies people might fight to establish a religious dictatorship. War aims have nominally included constructs that were not even remotely realistic, such as to obtain command of the sea, or to establish or supposedly even restore a global universal monarchy. And war aims beyond the planning of central authority can be articulated, with or without serious consequences. In the First World War, French soldiers rode à Berlin on railway wagons as they left for the front, and German soldiers sang Wir fahren gegen England, we go against England. Turning again to our theme of the imposition of order on the chaos of war, laws restricting the way war is conducted, the jus in bello, can be traced to antiquity. We have already alluded to the long tradition of the West of self-denying ordinances, which define not only who could or could not be killed, but also when and how. Of course, what has been seen as accepted by theologians and lawyers often diverge from practice. Something not often thought of as war, which should be thought as war, can in fact be war in its most lethal form, the deliberate infliction of mass starvation, which within war, but also supposedly in times of peace. Think of the Holodomor and think of the Great Chinese Famine. Most victims of the 30 Years' War in Europe died during the 30 Years' War due to the effects of starvation. and of the estimated 26 million Soviet citizens who died in the Second World War, more than half of them were civilians starved to death as a consequence of the deliberate policy of Nazi Germany. Equally, on the micro level, it is astonishing to see what was and what was not regarded as an acceptable practice in war by successive generations of writers. Thus, in the 18th and 19th century, Western settlers in America got very exercised over scalping, when, in fact, this was something that the Native Americans thought was normal. Today, we would be more concerned about the welfare or the suffering of the living rather than that of the dead. There is, in the most recent times in the West, a move away from the intent to cause pain and destruction in war, which previously would have been seen as a standard element. In the Middle Ages, it would even have been seen as something that was necessary to bring the other side to heel and to give them a trial before that of eternal flames of hell after their life. Admittedly, what we claim to feel today does not always translate into practice. Think of our failure to adopt non-lethal weapons more widely for non-domestic conflict situations, where the militaries of the world seem to think that is pussyfooted and that is something to be led to a policeman. But it would be a serious option for de-escalating war. So on the one hand, there is a degree of convergence today in international law as to what is seen as an atrocity. On the other, the very persistence and revived enthusiasm, for example, for Sharia law shows that, again, we're looking at an area replete with human constructs with strong cultural dependency. I'm running out of time, so I have to fast forward a little. Just a brief word about the use of machines in war. Even in the Second World War, for some reason, populations of London were convinced that there was a difference between being bombed from the air by a bomber or being bombed by the drone presidents, the V-rockets and the dual bikes, and somehow thought that it would be worse for them to be killed by somebody who couldn't see them and who wasn't exposed to danger. I think this is a strange logic, I'm not even sure that there is a logic, but the same holds true now for debates about drone warfare, where a very interesting project in the University of Birmingham shows that despite the fact that in fact drones are more precise and that in many respects should be seen as ethically better than strikes from an aircraft, the very factor that Western populations think of them as immoral should be factored into decision making on the use of drones because it becomes a factor in its own right. To end with how wars end, the treatment of the defeated population has varied considerably in war, and that has always been a factor that, and the expectations of this treatment of the population, has always been a factor in whether wars were dragged out and whether populations were willing to surrender or not. To give you just one example, that the Japanese populations were so convinced that they would be very ill-treated by the Americans, due to their own propaganda, led to mass suicides on the island of Okinawa and the fear that Japanese women had that they would be subjected to mass rape. Interestingly enough, this was really not part of the American culture, as the Germans understood very, very quickly, whereas the Russians did indulge in mass suicides at the end of the Second World War. The Russian soldier might not know that he'd survive, might not even count on surviving, but the one thing he did seem to count on was that he'd be allowed to rape. Russian soldiers themselves, victims obviously of a monstrous regime that sent them into war as cannon fodder, were also known in Germany as the ones to be feared, and in Germany it was very quickly known in 1944-45 that what you wanted to be was in the American sector, not in the Russian sector, or in the areas to be conquered by the Americans and the Russians, something that the Japanese didn't understand when thousands and thousands of Japanese women committed suicides in expectations of terrible things to come. Expectations about how wars end are also linked to, at least the victors' expectations, of what should happen after it is ended. What situations post them can be regarded as stable, i.e. when can peace be considered to be lasting? While death and destruction are always consequences of wars, other consequences can include the integration of the defeated country and people into the realm of the victor. And most recently, a book by a Roman enthusiast, Ian Morris, has argued that in fact, most people have benefited from being integrated in such a way into the empire of conquering power, because in the long term, the happiness of the many was bought at the expense of the suffering of the few. But today, even a few can mean millions. So I think the ethics of that definitely need to be revisited. To conclude, therefore, in my own project, I do not want to leave it at deconstructing all these concepts. Ultimately, I aim to identify areas of broad convergence and consensus in the hope of establishing a new, more generally valid paradigm of war in its many dimensions. Only thus can we delimitate the subject afresh and then study its causes and nature more fruitfully. This will be necessary before we come to the final and at once the most important question that I want to raise today. Whether war, which roughly I define as organized mass conflict with lethal consequences, could be banned not only in theory, as it already was with the Briand-Kellogg Pact of 1958, but whether it could also be eradicated in practice, and what conditions would have to be fulfilled to do so. Different prescriptions have been made over time, from the idea